dreamed a dream in time gone by.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. As always, you can listen to us all across the Civic Media Network and join the conversation at 844-967-2789. So, still the world's most popular musical, Les Miserables. We're bringing this up because Les Mis is back in Milwaukee. It started last weekend. It's running through Sunday at the Marcus Performing Arts Center. But Jane, how many times do you think you've seen Les Mis?
I think I've seen it 4.
Live?
Yes.
So I think I've seen it twice live, but I remember the 10-year, like the recorded performance of the 10-year anniversary. I don't even know how many times I've seen that. But then there's like multiple movies. I was so obsessed with this musical as a kid. And I tried to read the novel.
By Victor Hugo.
Because I loved the musical so much. I think it was like 7th or 8th grade. And it was a little dense. I'm not sure. I think a lot of things went over my head. But to talk about the long-lasting legacy and why this story is still so impactful and gets at the heartstrings of so many people, our guest this half hour is Professor Ben Platick, who is an associate professor of romantic literature at Marquette University and a lifelong Les Mis fan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Kristen. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you. So I guess just right off the bat, what's better, the play, movie, or musical? I mean, a play, movie, or book?
Oh, that's such an unfair question. They're all so different. And that's one of the glorious things about this book is that it can sustain so many different adaptations, doing so many different things. I mean, as a literature professor, it is kind of my job to say, this book is great and you should read
it.
Oh my God, it's massive.
It's 3.5 pounds in this edition, which is a really good translation, a newish translation by Christine Donahue. You can see there, but
I just have to describe it since this isn't a audio medium for anyone who's not watching the live stream. That was thicker than I think any dictionary I've ever seen. And that was definitely not the version I tried to even read in eighth grade. But it was much, much thinner than that. That is a massive.
That's phone book sized.
Oh yeah, it's huge. My students have gotten made fun of a little bit for carrying it around campus sometimes.
So you teach the book in one of your classes.
Yes, I'm actually teaching a semester-long course on the book right now. It's the only book we're reading, which is still a lot more reading sometimes than other classes. But my students have been troopers about it, and they have deepened my own relationship with this book, which is really fantastic. I read it for the first time when I was 16. I don't remember now if I'd actually heard or seen the musical first, but okay. I fell in love with the book, and I've tried to read it once or twice a decade ever since, and it changes every time.
So when you see the length of the actual original written piece, even translated, compared to what can fit into a 3-hour musical or the movie versions, and there are multiple movie versions, one that is the musical with Anne Hathaway and who really proved how much he can't sing, the Australian actor, Russell Crowe.
Yes.
It's like, oh, not a great Javert. But then even before that, Liam Neeson was in a version with Claire Danes as Cosette, and Liam Neeson was in it, and that was no musical. But what do you miss? How many more plot lines or details that you think are really important that are in the book that if you've only seen the musical, you don't even know of?
Actually, honestly, the musical does a pretty good job of capturing the core plot of the book. One of the interesting features of this text is that so many of these pages, and for audio listeners, I'm holding up the book and kind of like rifling through it. So many of these pages are not plot-based, but kind of essays that Hugo included as part of the historical context he wanted to give readers. So there's 50 pages on Paris' sewers. There's 50 pages on the Battle of Waterloo. There's 50 pages on slang.
Oh, wow.
And one of the one of the reasons Hugo does this is because one of the key points the book is making is that all of the terrible social problems that the book chronicles in the lives of individual characters are systemic problems. And he wants to give you the context for those systemic problems. So he says, you know, here's a family in poverty. Here's what poverty in Paris looked like over the past 20 years. Here are the causes that led to it, both historical, social, and cultural. And so the musical can't include a ton of essays. Yeah. What it does do a really good job of is actually having choruses of essentially effectively marginalized people singing as if they were a Greek chorus, the points that the essays make. So, for example, the musical opens with the convicts saying, "Hi, the French penal system is terrible. Look down. You're going to always be somebody who society looks at as a lesser person." And, you know, this book, if nothing else, is a treatise that is like a very early version of what we now call prison abolition. Ugo does not think prisons do a good job at all of, you know, trying to put criminals back into society. He actually thinks that they, you know, prisons create more criminals. And so that's the kind of context that you can't really replicate in anything, honestly, except a long book. But the musical does a pretty damn good job.
And so in the historical context of when Victor Hugo wrote this book, how far removed were they from, because I don't know the timeline, how far removed were they already from the French Revolution?
So the French Revolution began officially in 1789. Hugo published this book in 1862. So, it's a generation later, almost 100 years later. However, the book, I like to tell people that the book is and is not about the French Revolution because its focus is one of the various aftershocks of the French Revolution, the 1832 June Rebellion. But it's a book that is primarily concerned with the massive seismic changes that the French Revolution caused across Europe and in its symbolism as a revolution that technically failed but spiritually succeeded because it brought the hope to Europe that eventually other European nations could overthrow their monarchies and institute something that looked like democracy. And Hugo actually began writing the book in the 1830s and 40s, so well before it eventually was published. And the major difference and kind of like major shift to the book happened in 1848, which was the other major, major revolutionary year in the 19th century when countries across Europe overthrew their monarchs, tried to institute democracy. Some of them succeeded, some of them didn't. France very briefly, after having gone back to a monarchy after the French Revolution, instituted a second republic, which lasted for all of, maybe a year or so before the French, and I don't know why this story is relevant now to preface this remark. The French elected Napoleon III, who was a nephew of the original Napoleon, who was a kind of demagogue, who then a year later staged a coup and made himself emperor. So that profoundly disillusioned Hugo. He got exiled by this new Napoleon because he was a little R Republican who was like, you know what, democracy is a great thing. The death penalty is bad. And maybe we should do something about economic equality. Napoleon was like, bye. And so he lived in exile for the next like couple of decades of his life and published Les Mis from exile. So it's the book is also kind of a critique of Napoleon III and also of the French people's tendency to sort of elect demagogues who then take over the country.
That's all fascinating. We're talking to Professor Ben Platic, who is the Associate Professor of Romantic Literature at Marquette University and is currently teaching a course on Les Miserables, the book, and we're talking about this because Les Mis, the musical, is at the Marcus Performing Arts Center this weekend. And so I want to get back into more like the historical context, because one of the things I think as a kid, and even Jane and I were talking about this the other day, is a misconception about the musical is the context of the fight scene, like the war, the battle, right? And then in reality, historically, it was not even a blip on the actual revolution or anything. And it was like squashed so quickly that in history books is basically not even mentioned. And it's really only this story, this novel, that brought to light the historical context of that battle, right?
Yes, absolutely. We only kind of know/care about the 1832 June Rebellion because of Les Mis.
Which is so funny to me. So, but what do you think it is? Because it's obviously for us as Americans, this is not our history. This is something that happened a very long time ago in a different country as far as where the story is set. And yet, whether it's the book, the musical, the movies, like this has such a place in our, for those of us who like musical theater, in our hearts. And so what do you think the themes of the story are that get its hooks into so many people?
So to connect that to your point about no one really remembering the 1832 rebellion, I think it's a profoundly idealistic book that puts all of its faith in the real possibility of political change. And Ugo could have done this story by talking about a moment where change really happened. Like, he could have said it in 1848. He could have actually written a book about the revolution. He did a few years later. It's called 93. It's about the terror. But instead, he chose to write about a rebellion that failed. And part of the book, like, I think what makes the book so meaningful to every generation that has come after it is that it is the book about how even in times of political darkness and political failure, you have to keep the faith and believe that history is going to get better, that people are going to institute the kinds of changes they want to see in their governments that make the world a better place for everybody. And the book believes in this so profoundly, in part because it tells the story of a moment where, you know, in practical terms, it didn't happen. The revolution, this little rebellion, did fail. But so many of Ugo's long speeches throughout the book are these kind of rousing discussions of why we should try to keep the faith and keep fighting. And I think that that theme is really resonant across history for so many people. And it's why the musical, for example, ends with a kind of singing again of the song, Do You Hear the People Sing, is because I think this book has come down through history as a book about, you know, what happens when your revolution fails? Well, you keep fighting, and here's why.
Oh, that was so well said. And I had the music of that song in my ear, and I got chills just thinking, because it's so powerful of like how the show ends. And also, but it's also so sad. I mean, almost everyone dies. And thinking about all of the themes that are obviously the revolution part, but the penal colony and the poverty and the sickness and everything that was happening as far as, but the, you still end this show. And I'm assuming, since I never actually finished the book, you finish the book feeling like, well, at least not depressed, and that you do feel somewhat hopeful as far as the desire to keep going. And so Victor Hugo, was he also a journalist? Was he just a novelist, or who, like, what was his, was he just a Renaissance man who did a lot of different things?
He was a little bit of a Renaissance man. He wrote an absolutely staggering amount. The kind of fun story that I like to tell about him is that he always hit his word count every day because he didn't let his servant bring him clothes until he'd hit it. That's apocryphal, but I like telling it. So he was somebody who was deeply interested in social justice and did do a lot of what we would now kind of call investigative reporting. His first major novel was actually kind of based on a real life story. It came out in 1829. It's called The Last Day of a Condemned Man. And it was about a man who was sent who was guillotined for a minor offense. And that kind of deeply shaped the way that Ugo understood his relationship to his work. And so there's a very real way in which every single one of his books is political, and he does a ton of research to produce them. He also wrote a bunch of essays, and eventually, before getting exiled, was in the French National Assembly, where he stood up for universal suffrage, free education, getting rid of the death penalty, and economic justice. Interestingly, as a conservative, so that word does not mean necessarily what you think it means in 19th century France.
Yes, words change. There's different definitions of all those things. Because when you were describing as far as the book having so all these essays, the first thing that popped in my head was Upton Sinclair and the Jungle, and the what was a novel but was also a piece of investigative reporting, and what that did to shape the labor movement in this country. And so it's interesting to put that into context as far as there was purpose behind the writing besides just telling a great story.
Absolutely. Ugo does not let you escape reading the book without knowing exactly where he stands on a number of important issues and kind of hitting you over the head with what he thinks ought to be done.
That's so funny. All right. Well, we're going to keep you through the break because I think not only is there probably more, I have another couple questions as far as character development of Les Miserables, but we also want to talk because you're writing a novel that takes place in Wisconsin. So we'll come full circle with that. Our guest this half hour is Professor Ben Platek, who is an associate professor of romantic literature at Marquette University. Stay with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Killed the dream. I you hear the people sing, singing the song of angry men. It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. We could probably just play that for the next 8 minutes, but then we wouldn't be able to talk to our guest for this half hour, Professor Ben Vladek, who is the Associate Professor of Romantic Literature at Marquette University and is teaching a course this semester on the book Les Miserables. And we're talking about this because Les Miserables, you can still see it this weekend at Marcus Performing Arts Center in Milwaukee. And my question for both of you is, which character do you most identify with from Les Miserables?
Oh my God, what a great question. That has changed with every, the older I get, it shifts. When I was younger, I mean, I'm basically a professor because of a speech Enver Loss makes two-thirds of the way through the book where he says, light, light, everything comes from light and everything returns to it. Citizens, the 20th century, or the 19th century was great, but the 20th century will be happy. And it's a speech where he's saying, you know what the most important thing is? Education. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to become a professor. These days, I find myself actually, you know, relating a bit more to Jean Valjean and even to Marius's grandfather, who are these kind of older people who watch the tremendously powerful and brave things that the younger generation are doing, and want to protect them, especially, and, you know, help them through what will eventually become a kind of disillusionment, because that's the process of the book. You know, you are young, the barricades fail, you're disillusioned, how do you keep going? And so now I'm, you know, I'm not like super old yet, but I'm at the stage in my life where I am teaching a bunch of students who are full of like really amazing idealism, and I want to help them.
Like, help them, protect them, but also like keep going. It's inspiring. But yes, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Jane, do you have a...
Professor, you described that so well, I am stealing that answer. And because I am old, and I do feel that, even just with the people that I work with.
Yeah. And you demonstrate that. You're constantly... Yeah,
well, you want to nurture, you want to nurture them and take care of them and make sure that, you know, the things are okay.
That's funny. I feel like my answer, as I always wanted to play Eponine, had I been able to sing, the amount of times I tried to sing her main song. But in reality, if we were to be honest, I was probably a lot more like Cosette. As far as I was not a tough street kid, as even though I played one in A Christmas Carol. So I think most of us always thought Eponine was, like, when she dies, a little drop of rain. Sheesh. All right, so enough a lot about Les Miserables, because I want to talk a little bit more about your work, because you have a book, your second novel coming out next year.
Oh, no, it's first novel.
Oh, this is your first novel, okay.
Yeah, first novel, second book.
What is that? What's the difference? So the book was nonfiction?
The first one is an academic book, yeah.
Got it. Okay, so I misread that. So first novel, and it takes place in Wisconsin.
It does, yes.
So what? Can you tell us more of the plot?
Sure. So it's called Dryland. It is about a forester in the early 20th century who discovers that he has this kind of magical ability to grow plants, and is immediately drafted to grow war timber in World War I. Pretty soon after he discovers this magical power, he discovers that all the plants he creates die. And he's a fervent conservationist and preservationist, and desperately wants to kind of use his power to restore some of the ecological landscapes that he loves so dearly, especially Wisconsin, and especially a marsh that I've named Clearwater Marsh, but is actually Horican. And so the story sort of follows him trying to make his power work for conservation. And it ties in a lot of Aldo Leopold's work, and it also ties in the early 20th century dredging and refilling of Horican Marsh.
Wow. How did you come up with this story?
I moved to Wisconsin. I've only lived here for like 8-9 years at this point. And one of the things that I have fallen in love with about the state is the natural landscapes and the just rich history of sort of ecology that exists here. And I was inspired by reading Leopold's writing, but also by looking at the really interesting history of the various kind of ecological areas of the state. So everything from the Driftless to the sand counties in the middle of the state to the Northwoods, which were all cut down, and then people tried to make them into farms, and that kind of failed, and they ended up being national forests, a lot of that land. So I find that history immensely interesting.
But I still wonder, Professor, I mean, are you laying in bed one night and you go, you know, he's got a magical power and I'm going to call him Walter?
Basically, I mean, the other thing that I'm interested in is just the difficulty of conservation. And I think sometimes we often wish for magical solutions to long-standing and seemingly like irresolvable problems like climate change. So I was like, what if in the early days when clear cutting was still happening, somebody had a magic power to reverse clear cutting? And it kind of doesn't really work because ecological restoration isn't accomplished by magic. It's accomplished by, you know, years of labor and working together and understanding the land that you're on. So there is no magic fix.
How much did you know? How much research did you have to do? Because I feel like it's always fascinating to me as far as creative writers, novelists, who have a story that they so want to tell. And it's not unlike Les Mis, right? There is the historical fiction of it all, of the amount of research and understanding of the time, the profession, the like you said, what did conservation look like back then? And so how much did you already build on knowledge that you knew, and how much research actually did you have to go do in order to write the story you wanted to write?
So the knowledge basis that I had was having a kind of from... I'm a romanticist by trade, so I study 18th and 19th century British literature, where people cared an awful lot about nature. So I have a kind of, I was already familiar with ideas about what nature is and meant kind of in the European and American context in the 19th century. And I know from just doing a lot of hiking around Wisconsin, like I have a familiarity with the landscapes. In terms of the specific context of, you know, like the early forestry service, World War I, and some of the people that I based the, you know, the book on, or the people's writing, like I did end up doing a lot of reading. One of the kind of main things I did was read a whole bunch of old forestry manuals and ecology textbooks from the early 20th century to try to get a sense of how did people actually think, you know, ecology worked? Like what did they know? What did they not know? And that was a large part of my reading, as was just like everything about Leopold, who was such a great documentarian of those shifting tendrils and ecological thought, as well as a beautiful writer of Wisconsin nature.
Oh, well, I can't wait. It sounds so niche, but also fascinating. So it comes out next year?
Yeah, fall 2023 from University of Wisconsin Press, which is so appropriate because the book wouldn't exist without their back catalog.
Absolutely. There you go. That's incredible. And so where else, before we let you go, where else can people find either your work or your social online presence?
So if Twitter exists in a year, I'm at bplatic at Twitter. And there's a link to my website from my Twitter profile. But you can also just kind of Google Ben Platic, and my Marquette University webpage pops up. So those are probably the easiest places to find me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I already learned so much more about Les Mis, despite loving it for so long, than I already knew. And so I'll have to follow up with you at the end of the semester to see what the grading curve was for all your students reading that long, long book.
They're all awesome. They've done such a good job.
Well, thank you so much. Professor Ben Platic is Associate Professor of Romantic Literature at Marquette University. We thank you for joining us today, and we'll have to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great pleasure.
All right. Have a great day. Okay. We'll take a break for the top of the hour news. And when we come back, Molly Haggerty, a volleyball alum, will be here to talk about the NCAA tournament.